Good afternoon. This is Dr. John Pinheiro, and you're listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. Today we're going to look into something that Edmund Burke referred to as those little platoons in society. That is all the different associations, private and otherwise, which really make up a good society and help contribute to human flourishing and aid us in finding the truth, and hopefully we think in finding our salvation. And so I've invited to the show today Chris Fisher, who is the executive director of the Portsmouth Institute out of Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Mr. Fisher graduated summa cum laude from Salve Regina University with a degree in politics. Some of you might be familiar with his work as the former associate editor for the Intercollegiate Review. That's published by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. We have one of their chapter clubs at Aquinas College here in town, and they do great work. And he also edited the online version of that same journal, and he's written for Ethica Politica as well. And since summer of 2014, he's been directing the Portsmouth Institute, and we're going to talk about that institute today, as well as a few other things. Chris, welcome to Faith and Reason.
Yeah, thanks, John. It's great to be here.
Sure. Well, why don't we start off and tell our – let's clue our listeners into what the Portsmouth Institute is all about, how you've been there since just this past summer. But I'd be curious at least in knowing, I guess, how old is it? And then we'll talk about your mission and goals and get a sense for the kinds of things you're doing.
Sure, yeah. So the Institute is actually founded in 2009. So since then, it's been an initiative of Portsmouth Abbey and more recently of a joint cooperation between Portsmouth Abbey and St. Louis Abbey, which is in St. Louis, Missouri. So it's existed for about 5 years, and like you mentioned, I just came on this summer in 2014 as the new executive director as we kind of start to expand our scope, expand the programs that we do, and help kind of serve the church and especially the intellectual mission of the church in new ways. So starting in 2009, the Portsmouth Institute hosted basically one conference per year on a different topic related to Catholic thought, whether that was Shakespeare, you know, is Catholic Shakespeare, to looking in the into the intellectual tradition of the church through Cardinal Newman. There was a conference on modern science, ancient faith. So all different topics, you know, that can help society kind of retrace our steps, look at the Catholic intellectual tradition, and see how it can form, you know, what society looks like today, and really contribute to critical areas that we're facing.
What led Portsmouth Abbey to found this institute in the first place? Was it particular problems they discerned in society, or something that, that's a Benedictine abbey, correct?
Yeah, right. So I guess you don't typically think of Benedictine monks, which there are here. They oversee all the activities of the abbey. You don't necessarily think of them as kind of outward looking and really wanting to change society. You know, they're here at the abbey. They dedicate their attention to their own spiritual lives and also the lives of the students here at the boarding school. But I think that there's an awareness that, especially the Benedictine tradition and just Catholic thought in general, really should have more of a say in our society, and that there's a really great tradition here at Portsmouth Abbey of intellectual exploration and of spiritual development, and they wanted to get that message out there and raise the Abbey's profile and at the same time, you know, influence our culture. And that's kind of the center of where we're at. You know, obviously the Benedictines have a long tradition shaping Western civilization. And it wasn't always intentional that happened, but just the way that history played out, that's how it occurred. So if we can share the fruits of that wisdom, that tradition with our society, we think it's best for all of us, especially for the church and for faithful Catholics.
And so that old Benedictine role of providing these places in our society that can contribute to the building of Catholic culture and save what's still good in our culture and perpetuate it, this is what you're about then at the Portsmouth Institute.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, we are dedicated to an exploration of Catholic thought kind of in total, you know, of the tradition of Catholic thought. But we do have the benefit, I think, of being a Benedictine institution. And, you know, you mentioned the little platoons when you introduced the show. There's kind of a few better examples of properly organized, constructive communities rooted in the natural law than Benedictine monasteries and Benedictine communities. So yeah, we're kind of digging into that well, you know, and letting that help shape what we do in all things.
Now, are Benedictine monasteries, those, they're all independent, aren't they, of one another?
They are. There are congregations, though. So Portsmouth Abbey here is part of actually the English Benedictine congregation, which is the oldest of the Benedictine congregation, started, I think, in the beginning of the 11th century. And obviously went into a bit of a hiatus after after, you know, the 1500s.
Sure.
For about 150 years or so, where they basically fled to France. But then they were reconstituted in the early 1600s. And then in the early 20th century, monks from Downside Abbey in England came here and started the Portsmouth Abbey. And monks from Ampleforth Abbey in England went to St. Louis and started St. Louis Abbey. So those two abbeys, and also St. Angelo's in D.C., all three of those have a connection to the English Benedictine congregation.
And so that's why then the Institute is now sponsored by those two abbeys, St. Louis and Portsmouth. Then.
That's right.
So that's the connection.
Right. So,
okay,
so there's, you know, yeah. And like you said, there's basically a loose affiliation, but as close as you can get in Benedictine monasteries, the two are affiliated.
And so when you hold your conferences, which we'll talk about in a moment, will people need to go to St. Louis? Will they go to Portsmouth, Rhode Island? Where do you hold these?
Yeah, so the conferences have always been in Portsmouth, and that's where we're going to host them in the future. We're blessed here with a beautiful natural surrounding. We're right on the Narragansett Bay, which, if you're familiar with New England geography, is just this, you know, expansive, beautiful setting here, and home to a lot of historic events in American history, which makes it a great place to be. But so Portsmouth Abbey is nestled right along the banks there, so we offer a beautiful setting to have a conference, especially in June, which is when our conferences typically run.
Okay. Well, what kind of conferences have you had in the past? So your aim at the Institute, as you said, is to take advantage of the Catholic intellectual tradition, to explore it to the benefit of our culture. What have you done thus far? You're not that old of an institute, 2009, I think.
Yep.
You know, I think that may be the same year we began Catholic studies at Aquinas College. So I'd say that was a pretty good year.
Yeah, right.
But so what have you been able to do in that time, the kinds of things you've explored?
Sure. So, for instance, in 2013, we had a conference on Catholicism and the American Experience, and that was really a broad look at American culture, the compatibility of Catholicism in this kind of modern liberal society, what we have to contribute, where we have to be cautious, and kind of how can we best move forward, and just looking at the history of Catholics in America as well. So we had Dr. Robert George here to give a talk. George Weigel came. Robert Kimball from the New Criterion gave a talk on art and Catholicism in America, which was really fascinating. So kind of a real robust conversation with key players in Catholic intellectual thought today. And we hope to just build off that tradition going forward and really, you know, allow Catholics in New England, but also beyond. You know, we had attendees from across the country. We had speakers from across the world, Spain, England, South America, that came and presented, you know, over the course of the five conferences over 5 years. So it's a great program. The people that come benefit greatly from it, and we're just so excited to be continuing that going forward into 2015.
Do you have proceedings from that conference either published or available online?
We have them published in print form and in ebook in a volume called the Portsmouth Review, and there's a review available for each of the conferences.
Oh, wonderful!
So they're definitely worth purchasing. The print versions are now all available online in ebook version. They're just such great material in there. I love going through it.
And to get one of those, will we go to PortsmouthAbbey.org or to another website?
You can go to PortsmouthInstitute.org, or you can just go right to Amazon, type in Portsmouth Review, and all the products should come up there with all the proceedings.
Yeah, say what you want. Amazon makes sure makes the buying of books and things easier.
Exactly.
What about some, before we move on to some of your own work, your own scholarship, how about some upcoming events that we might expect that maybe some of our listeners might want to attend? Here in Grand Rapids, we're not that far from New England, so you might find a few local folks hopping in a van, since you hold these in June usually, and coming to see you. What do you have upcoming for us?
Yeah. So June, in June we'll be welcoming people from across the country to our conference.
Okay. Winter will just be ending here in Grand Rapids in June, so people will be ready to, they'll be ready to vacation.
Yeah. Exactly. So our conference then will be on Pope Francis and the Church in the 21st century, which, you know, it will just be a really fun look at the direction of the Church and what implications that has for our politics, our economics, the church structure itself. Obviously, there's a lot of interesting dialogue going on there right now, and also our evangelization efforts, you know, because we are very much in the intellectual space of the Catholic Church, and we're trying to influence ideas on the highest levels at the Portsmouth Institute that can help change our culture. But at the end of the day, Pope Francis is right. We are an evangelistic church, so looking at kind of all of that in the Franciscan strain, I guess you could call it, is what we'll be doing in June. So stay tuned for more details there. They are to come, and that should be a great conference. We have accommodations right here at the Abbey, so you get to kind of experience the communal life for yourself when you come to the conference. So it's great fun.
And will that. Is that before the follow-up to the recent Synod on the Family?
It is.
A few months before that?
Yep. It'll be a few months before that. So we'll kind of be looking ahead at that, and maybe in 2016 we can look back and see what happened. And then maybe we'll have more to say about Catholicism in the 21st century from there.
Do you have any opinions you'd like to share with us today, your take on the Synod proceedings, not really what it produced, but the way it played in media in the United States and the way it seems to have been intended to play, perhaps, by Pope Francis. It's hard to say from the outside.
Yeah, you know, I think that in part, the media does add hype to these things, right? But there are inherent problems, like Archbishop Chaput was saying, to confusion. And I think that maybe there was some confusion going on within the Synod itself. But really what we have to look at now is, what's going to come out of the follow-up next fall, what changes, if any, will actually be made, and what will that mean for the Church and for our ability as Orthodox Catholics to practice our faith. And that's really what I think about, and when I talk to people, what I'm most concerned with is let's not forget that there are people who are trying to live a life of orthodoxy and commitment, and obviously we're all sinners, so we're all struggling with that problem. But when we focus on one category of people and one category of sin, we might risk forgetting about other problems and alienating people who also need the help of the Church and the guidance of the Church and lay people and all people who have a life of virtue in mind. When we're looking at what the Synod produced or what happened there, let's just keep in mind that you know, the Holy Spirit's at work in our lives as individuals, so we need to make sure to be conscious of how we bring others to the faith as well.
All right. I do worry. I have to admit that I do worry when we focus on particular issues as Catholics. There seems to be a tone sometimes by cardinals, maybe by Pope Francis, where this concern that the Orthodox Catholics are somehow too puritanical or closed-minded, and that there's a problem there, and by we want to be merciful and welcome all sinners with open arms, but you know the Orthodox Catholics are sinners too, and they're trying to do the best they can, one assumes,
right,
to live a good life, and then to be told that in trying to do that, they're somehow they're not being compassionate and nice enough. I'm not sure that's a great message for the overall church either. So I hope somehow we cut through all this to really have the new evangelization, evangelize everybody, but not to shut down those who have been fighting in the trenches, they think, for a very long time on certain social issues that are really affect our culture.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And again, I'll go back to something that Archbishop Chaput said in his Erasmus lecture at First Things a few weeks ago, when he said that, the church accepts everybody because Jesus accepts everybody, but not on our own terms. On Jesus' terms are we accepted into the church. And, you know, yes, Jesus did break bread with sinners, with prostitutes and all the rest, but he said, repent, and that's really the center of Christ's message is repent. He didn't say, keep doing what you're doing. It's all good as long as you follow me and believe what I say, but don't actually practice it. You can come and break bread with me. He said, change your life and follow me. So that's what we need to remember, that we need to do every day as Orthodox believers, people who are trying to diligently live the faith, but also to people that we bring in. And obviously you approach them with a posture of love and welcomeness, but I don't see that as something as really a new insight. I think that's something that the church has been practicing since its existence, better or worse, maybe, throughout those times. But, it's not something new, maybe something that needs a renewed focus, but it's not groundbreaking. I think that's necessarily the case.
So our contemporary culture doesn't make it easy, of course, to be a good, conscientious, and diligent Catholic. It makes it more difficult. We're not living in a Christian culture. Perhaps it's a post-Christian culture. Maybe it's a post-post-Christian culture. I'm not sure, but it is quite difficult. And so one of the things I thought, Chris, that you and I could talk about today is how we can, as Catholics, understand our culture, understand what needs to be done, and what kind of insights you might have into doing what it took the Benedictines about 1,000 years to do in their monasteries, and that is, as Christopher Dawson says, transform the Rome of the gladiators and the pagans into the Rome of, or into the Europe of Dante and Thomas Aquinas and St. Francis. And 1,000 years to build Christendom. If we're in post-Christendom, this is maybe, as C.S. Lewis said, this is probably a more difficult task, converting this kind of culture than converting a pagan culture, which at least tried to grasp the transcendent. So I guess my question for you is, I know you've done some studies on Durkheim and looking at culture and how to understand some of the most devastating and deadly things in our culture, and not just seeking to end them through coercion, but changing people's hearts and minds themselves and changing culture that way, and making this country we live in just more conducive to being able to live the Christian life. If you could, for a minute, why don't you tell us who Durkheim was and why we ought to be aware of his work?
Yeah, and I think that we should be aware of Durkheim's work, and I'll make the caveat right up front that Durkheim isn't some kind of Catholic scholar. He's a secular Jew living in France at the end of the 19th century. But he comes from a close-knit Jewish family. His father was a rabbi, And he had some great insights. You know, it's frequently the case that sometimes the truth can come through, you know, unexpected places, and it's not always necessarily, Catholic art, for instance, isn't always what appears up front as purely Christian. But of course, the truth can be revealed in a variety of ways. So I would look to Durkheim for that. So Durkheim is engaging in his practice of sociology at the end of the 19th century, when sociology really is something quite new. And in fact, his book Suicide, which is kind of the book that I'm most interested in right now, is really a groundbreaking work in sociology, both in the amount of data that's collected, in actually kind of living out the sociological method that Durkheim is really pioneering at this time, and in really trying to understand how social structures affect human action, which is a big topic. And so Durkheim is looking at that in his book Suicide through one angle in particular. You know, what kind of social structures are most conducive to suicide, which is, it's obviously an action that's always been with us. Some people say it's been with us almost as long as human natural death, you know. But there is different, different rates of suicide, different forms of suicide that Durkheim's looking at in different societies. And what he notices, and what I think is most instructive for us Catholics and for our broader culture, is that suicide rates are lower in Catholic societies than in Protestant. So Durkheim's looking at this, and he's seeking to understand why. Why is that the case? Is it the case that individuals actually act kind of on totally their own volition, that we can understand the action of suicide devoid from the social structures that it occurs in? Or do we have to actually look at the social structures first in order to then understand the individual action, in this case, suicide? And that's what he relies on. So he kind of, goes on this quest looking for what he calls the ruptures in the social fabric that could be causing these higher suicide rates.
Now he's just studying European countries.
That's right. So he's not, he's not in America. He's not in East. So Prussia, France, Spain, Italy, the northern European countries, England to some extent. Although England is a bit more looser for him, I think, because it's a Protestant society with a hierarchy, so it's a bit confusing for him.
I guess that's why I was wondering. So the United States would be, what would he call that? I guess I was thinking, and certainly England an outlier. And when you mentioned the statistics are then suicide had lower rates in Catholic societies than in Protestant ones, and my temptation as a scholar would be to relate that to ideas, but the Protestant nations are mostly in the north and the Catholic nations are mostly in the south. Did he wonder, or do you wonder, if this is just a matter of dark and cold weather in the north in the winter and kind of the sunny Mediterranean climate in the south? The days of the Roman Empire where you might fall on your sword or something are gone in the south, but the sunny weather's still there.
Right, exactly. So he actually spends the first half of his book looking at basically any other factor besides the one he's going to justify, and seeing if it's actually a cause of suicide. And in that, he looks at mental illnesses. He looks at climate. He calls the cosmic factors, the meteorological factors. And he says essentially no. He takes them very seriously, but he dismisses them. And kind of one easy way for me to sum that up, and kind of the main takeaway from his study of climate and climate's effect on suicide, is that in the northern European societies, and really in all countries, the coldest months, the darkest months, are the months with the the least amounts of suicide. The highest rates occur in the spring and summer. So he has this this great quote, which I'll have to paraphrase, but it's something like, man ends his life when conditions are easiest, or something like that. So that's how he basically says, no, you know, this is not a matter of climate. This is a matter of social structure, and especially in his distinction between Catholic societies and Protestant, how the individual is integrated into society and how his moral actions are regulated. And that's what it comes down to for Durkheim. And of course, there's a much stronger social inclusion and dependency in Catholic societies than in Protestant. And that's what he sees as the root for these causes.
Go ahead. Could we talk about that for a minute, the individual in society? That's a common theme that crops up on Faith and Reason here, and that is the individual and the community, right? And the relationship of the individual to the community, and Aristotle's famous phrase, of course, that man is a creature of the polis, or a political animal, that it's natural to us. Even the pre-Christian Greeks noted, some of them did, like Aristotle, that we're born in community and we function best in community. This is what we're made for. But I would think that in Protestant societies, as Christian as they are, that's not as operative. Durkheim found that some they're more radically individualist in some way, and this is related to religion. Or how would you explain this?
Yeah, that's right. So what Durkheim is looking at, let's look at it quickly through the lens of suicide here. So he's saying that. That Protestant theology basically puts onto man the resources for his own survival. He is very much responsible for his own life and for his own destiny and for his own salvation. And what this did, and what this Protestant theology did, was overthrow the traditions and authority of the church. So in order to kind of create a new form of morality and theology, you had much more free inquiry in Protestant societies at the time of the Reformation and after. That led to all sorts of things. I mean, from that we have different economic arrangements, we have different church arrangements, you know. But at the core of it, you have man alone. In the face of God, without the intermediary institution. So one thing that Durkheim really focuses on here is penance, and Catholic guilt, and how do Catholics deal with their guilt and their sin, and how is that different from how Protestants do it? And obviously, there's a huge difference here. And like I said, you know, Durkheim isn't a Catholic or anything, but from kind of an anthropological standpoint, from a sociological standpoint. The way that Catholics are able to expend their guilt and confess their sins and be more assured of their salvation is a real kind of benefit to society. And for us practicing Catholics, we say, yeah, it's a benefit to society because it reflects the natural law, and because there are actually things here that are built into our nature that the church is reflecting. And so overthrowing that tradition has consequences. So I think that Durkheim really is operating off of at least Judeo-Christian anthropology when he's arguing that a society most conducive to human flourishing is one that integrates the individual into society and regulates his behavior. And he really comes up with the term collective conscience. Which he defines as kind of the totality of the beliefs and practices, the folkways, the mores of society, the common sentiments from which the individual conscience draws its moral sustenance. And his argument there is that these common sentiments are much more rigorously guided in Catholicism than in Protestantism, and that for him is one of the major factors for the lower suicide rates in European society at the end of the 19th century, when, of course, you have new innovations in science that are questioning man's relationship to God. You have a radical division of labor, which is, of course, another area of focus for Durkheim. And you have all things that are really upsetting man's traditional bonds to his community and to social order and to his God. So his book Suicide is really an interesting way to look at that and to look at the effect of Ideas of Consequences, right, is the great book by Weaver, and theological ideas maybe have the highest consequences.
Yeah.
So
I think he starts at the Reformation in that book.
Right.
You know, maybe a little bit earlier, but he just traces forward till you get to kind of the secular modern worldview. But it fascinates me how the ideas of great thinkers and complex thinkers, and even I would say good but unreadable philosophers in some cases, and I'm not calling Durkheim that, somehow their ideas do seep down into the common mind. Those who've not read them. And it might take centuries, but we see it happening. And when you talk about what Durkheim called the collective conscience, are you just referring to customs and tradition? That if you're in a society that's more likely to honor and keep the traditions of your ancestors, a Catholic society, as opposed to a society that places great emphasis on innovation and what is new and on changing the past, then you're more likely to feel rootless and in danger, I guess, in the latter one. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's right. So especially, when there is a rupture in the collective conscience, when it changes drastically, whether that's through revolution, whether that's through political revolution or theological revolution like the Reformation, or drastic changes in the social structure like we did see in the Industrial Revolution, which of course has roots in broader ideas. That's right. And I'll go back to the idea that ideas of consequences, and to kind of connect it with how we started the conversation, that's why I'm so excited about the work I'm doing with the Institute now, because if we want to shape society to better integrate the individual into the social order, and if we want to actually make sure that Catholic teaching and the intellectual tradition of the Church has an influence on our society, we do need to influence the ideas at the top that then filter down into society, through media, through academia, through politics, through the Church pulpit. And that's kind of an effort for the long haul. You mentioned that the Benedictines were influencing culture over more than a millennia. And, it's a big project. But
yeah, I'm not saying the Portsmouth Institute has a 300-year master plan.
Unless we can get the funding, if there's a donor out there who would like to make that happen.
That'd be quite an endowment. And,
right.
I'd probably send you an application for a position.
Yeah, right.
Back to these, I was fascinated by Durkheim saying no. So the cosmic factors, no. And I think there's some sense in what he says. But the time period he's writing then, and I may be off by a decade or so, I'm not sure, but it makes me think of Max Weber and the Protestant work ethic.
Yeah, right.
And that argument for innovation and material flourishing in Protestant countries as opposed to Catholic countries like, you could pick, let's not pick Italy, parts of Italy were flourishing, but let's say Mexico, or particularly in the New World. And how does capitalism fare in looking at Durkheim's work? Does he wrap it up in with Protestantism? Is it something separate? Is that somehow detrimental as well?
Yeah, I think he would wrap it up with Protestantism in a lot of ways, because capitalism is a focus on the individual, and it upsets the anthropological order. in really critical ways, where instead of having dependency and inclusion and reliance on the community, there's competition and ambition and individual desire to get ahead at all costs. So, I don't think he would use those words to describe Protestant theology, but I think he would definitely say that the focus on the individual in theology had those implications down the road. So Durkheim, Weber, and Marx are basically the three that are kind of really pioneering sociological study at this time. So you're right to include Weber there in that mix. I think he would definitely point to out capitalism and the division of labor, especially, as one of those institutions of modernity that are really challenging the individual in a lot of crucial ways.
This is Dr. John Pinheiro. I'm speaking with Chris Fisher, the executive director of the Portsmouth Institute. We've been talking this past 40 minutes or so, not only about the Institute, but about the great sociologist Durkheim and what his ideas relative to suicide in this case could tell us about society and what he called collective conscience and what happens when the customs and traditions of a society breaks down and man is left and even encouraged to be rootless and maybe innovative with no end game in mind. But we've been talking about Europe, Chris, and in the last segment of the show here, why don't we switch to the United States, which you said at least in terms of his suicide book, Durkheim did not study, and see what we can do by applying some of his ideas to the United States, to our social structures here, to what our society looks like, and to what Catholics would like it to look like. So if we believe then Durkheim's social scientific ideas, what do we see when we look at the United States? How might we take care of some of our problems, being a historically Protestant country, but really a very diversely religious country, I guess, with Christian roots? It's always hard to find a completely accurate description of what the United States is, but it's certainly more challenging, I think, than trying to describe a particular nation in Europe that has an official church and maybe a royal family connected to it and everything else.
Yeah, no, it is difficult. You're absolutely right. And I'm here in New England, which is my home, and where I'm now directing the Portsmouth Institute. And, we're, in terms of population and identification, we're a hugely Catholic area.
Which would have horrified the first founders of New England.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's really kind of ironic, that this great Puritan enclave is now almost fully Catholic in population. But it's interesting to see what that means in practice, so when Catholic immigration started here, in the early 1800s, but then especially later on, the late 19th century, and then continuing in the 20th century, you had these communities that were mostly strong in their faith. You could go into Southie and Boston, and even still today, people identify where they're from by their parish. Which is pretty neat. Here where I'm from, a town next to Fall River, Massachusetts, it's a strong Portuguese Catholic and Polish Catholic area.
Yeah, some of my family passed through there on the way from Portugal to California during the 20th century.
Great. Yeah. I'm full blood Portuguese myself. So Catholicism has always been kind of a part of my life, but it's interesting to see what that means actually in practice. And I think what it ends up happening is there's a desire among the immigrants to assimilate, right? don't speak your native tongue. Learn the folk ways and the traditions of America, and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and make a living, basically. And so what I think that assimilation ends up doing, they keep their Catholic identity, they keep going to church and all that, but they become functionally Protestant in a lot of ways by assimilating into American society, especially. These aren't necessarily highly educated immigrants. They can't defend the church in a theological argument. They have the devotion of the faith, but not really any deeper grounding than that. So when that's confronted by such a Protestant and by that time secularized Protestant society, it folds. So when I'm looking at what we can learn from Durkheim in America, I essentially take for granted that we're living in what Durkheim would identify as a Protestant society, even here in Catholic New England. But one way that I think we can really kind of take some of Durkheim's sociological method to America and try to understand some of the problems that we're facing in our individualistic society is through abortion. How is abortion in many ways caused by the social structures that we're living in, and what type of social arrangement would be more conducive to fewer abortions? What would actually help solve the problem? We do a lot of sidewalk pamphleteering and praying and all that, and marches in D.C. every year, and that's all great, but is it actually getting to the root of the problem? And I would think not. As Durkheim said, this isn't happening on an individual level. This isn't happening case by case. This is a larger social phenomenon.
But there are individuals hurting and confused and otherwise who are making these decisions because abortion is legal. So what you're saying, though, is to strike at the root of it. You have to do both, don't you? It's a both and situation. It's not an either or to just tend to the social structures and let society evolve to the point where this no longer seems to be an option.
So one thing that we have to look at first is, and I'll throw out these terms here just to help a bit. So Durkheim talks about three classifications of suicide that I think actually are pretty helpful for understanding abortion. He talks about egoistic suicide, which results from a lack of integration of the individual into society. He mentions altruistic suicide, which exists in societies where the individual is severely governed by custom and habit, and anomic suicide, which is a failure on the part of society as a whole to adequately regulate the individual. Now, I think in America we probably have more of a mixture of egoistic and anomic. So either those are occurring on an individual basis or even kind of mixed and combined in some settings. So I think that, when we think about a woman who decides to have an abortion, a lot of times we're looking at somebody who is destitute, who, may not have, she may not think that she has much other opportunity. She doesn't have another option. She doesn't have a family that acts as a social structure. She doesn't. She's operating an economy which is basically hostile to mothers, especially single mothers. There are a whole host of problems that she's facing. So for her, unfortunately, the only viable alternative would be to terminate the pregnancy. Like you said, any solution needs to go to, a both-and of helping the individual on a case-by-case basis and also arranging society to be more conducive to what I think is a Catholic anthropology and the natural law. And I think actually the two of those can happen at the same time. One area I think where the government and political action can really help out is by supporting pro-life community health centers, especially in low-income areas, where there's actually an opportunity for people to learn more about how to take care of their babies if they decide to have them, and where there's kind of a communal structure that replaces the family in some minimal way, but at least offers aid where it's needed. Also supporting some kind of living wage that actually makes it viable for families to support themselves, whether it's a single mother or even married families where both parents have to work. Maybe make it so that there could be family support with just one parent working, which is really difficult these days. And then another thing that always kind of bothers me, being a young Catholic, I am married, it's great to be starting family life, but there's this stigma, especially among conservatives, which is where I think it's most odd, against young adult children, and even young adults who are married, and maybe have children of their own, living with their families.
So the multi-generational household,
okay. Conservatives so often talk about this as if it's you're not making enough money, you're not succeeding in the economic world.
Get them out the door, right? They should be pulling their own weight at this point.
Right, okay. Right. And of course, there's perverted ways of doing this too, like making children stay on their parents' health insurance till 26. I don't know if that's necessarily the best way to do it.
I'm sure that was completely altruistic on the part of the federal government. I'm sure.
Right, right, exactly. But yeah. Making it possible and making it socially acceptable for families to live together, I think is a great way, and maybe even a way to help with some of the abortions that are occurring. Obviously, most of these happen in low income areas, but even for families that have, intact parents and can rely on the support of their broader family, that could be a way to restore some of the social structure that we so desperately need.
So to get to the root of it in America, at least, this may have started with the African American family, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan was pointing out, as early as the late 1960s and early 1970s. But it is now affecting also white families and others. And that is the breakdown of the family and the number one sign of poverty in the country, that is the single mother household, the single parent-headed household, which are usually single mothers. And I think of something that James Dobson said about, how to fix schools. And he said, you don't just throw money at the schools, and you can't just somehow cause the single mother to be paid more. Where's the money going to come from? You can you can tinker with the market. You can redistribute and take from person X and give to her. But in the end, you're not solving. You're causing other problems, perhaps, but also not solving the root problem. And what can Catholics do, or what can your institute help us do, or help society do, that will not just come up with practical fixes like something called a living wage, but try to put families back together? If this is the base unit of society, and you're the basic unit of society, not the individual, but the family, as the Catholics would say, but not all would say that. Others would say the individual, right? But if it is right. If it is the family, then that's what's got to be put back together. And how do you propose to do that?
Yeah, it's a big task, right? I mean, it's not something that I think you say, okay, let's restore the family and let's set out a five-point plan, and this is how we're going
to
do it.
It's countercultural it's countercultural not to think as a radical individualist in America.
Right, right. So I think part of it is getting the message right in the places that can actually change people. So, making sure that our church, when it's talking about issues of the family, that it takes a strong stance, and that it talks about the primacy of the family, and that it upholds Catholic teaching on that, and we'll see how that influences our politics and things like that that can actually make a change on that structure. But I think part of it comes from just actually talking about it and having that dialogue and trying to shape the ideas that influence society, like I was saying before, where Catholics, there are a lot of institutes like mine that are popping up across the country now, and there's a lot of energy going into Catholic thought. And I think that that's a very good thing. And I think that, you know, for too long, we haven't been really influencing the ideas, especially in American academia and American culture, that then do filter down. So I think maybe by forcing that dialogue in a lot of cases, hopefully we can start to see some long-term change. But it is long-term. But I think for the short term, you know, living by example is a great way to do it. You know, I was married when I was 23 years old, which is not very, it's not very frequent in our society.
That's considered getting married young these days.
Right? Yeah. So that's not something that happens very often. But, you know, I think that just as kind of that living example, I've helped inspire some of my friends who have done the same thing, you know, where maybe they never thought they could. So you know, actually living out the faith, you'll be surprised, can actually make an impact sometimes too.
Sure. So let me get to this, which seems like probably the most obvious criticism of arguing from a sociological perspective that stresses external factors and external social factors on the behavior of individuals. That all plays a role, but there's an argument that I would hear maybe more commonly among, I think, evangelical reformers, or what we might have heard as far back as the Second Great Awakening, and that is that if you convert people individually through Christ, this is the way you fix the culture. So thinking in terms of people and not structures. So I guess what would you say to a critic who says you're removing the blame for individual sins and transgressions by blaming structures rather than people, and maybe we ought to focus more on the individuals?
Yeah, you know, well, I guess I would reply first off by saying, you know, focusing more on individuals, it's hard to focus more on the individual than I think we already do in our society. Mm-hmm. So I think that we need to have a robust conversation about the community, about the society, and about what that actually looks like, and how the social order is really, you know, the prime factor for encouraging people to live a life of virtue. Because you know, you can go around, you know, I can convert somebody to Jesus Christ, and I can, you know, had that experience with them, but then what happens if I leave and this person is, you know, does not have a community around them to support them in living a life of virtue? What does that look like? How long can they possibly go on, I say just their belief? I mean, obviously you have to take into account divine grace, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's something that, you know, is absent in Durkheim. He's not talking about divine grace. You know, we have to think about what social structures are actually going to help encourage people to continue living the life of virtue even after they convert. Or, you know, in what ways does the society and the social structures that regulate moral behavior and that integrate the person to society, in what way is that itself an evangelistic effort, you know, and perhaps even more effective than, you know, the individual evangelizing case by case? You know, obviously, you know, I think this is, again, a both-and situation. You know, I don't think that all Christians should give up evangelizing and go on and write policy papers try to write tomes to get published by Harvard University Press or something. But I think that that we need to in order to sustain that that conversion of the soul, you also need a conversion of the habits, and that's sustained through the social order.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well said. So converting the habits, that's something. Even with grace, it's better done in community. That's where our habits are formed. And so,
So
our difficult task then as Americans, it seems, is to rebuild the fundamental community of the family.
Right, exactly. And one way that we can gain insight into that is through the Benedictine tradition. You know, when you read the rule, when you read St. Benedict's rule, there's a lot in there that applies to the family. You know, shared responsibilities, shared property, but an authoritative figure that holds accountable the other members of the order or of the family. So there's a lot to learn, from that tradition. But it is, like you said, it's the family. It's the family stupid.
Yeah, great bumper sticker. That has potential.
Yeah, right.
You mentioning the rule reminds me. I think it was a year or two ago. My wife, who I married, she was, let's see, how old was she? 21, and I was 22, getting ready to turn 23. So we were extremely young by American standards as well.
Right.
That was over 20 years ago. But she was reading the rule of Saint Benedict, and I asked her why. She was finding it just great devotional reading and very, very interesting, even though it's about how to order a monastery. That this is just something wonderful for all Catholics to read. It's very, very short, very thin. And there's some great commentaries out there on it.
No, it is. It's wonderful, and you know, lay people can actually become an oblate of the of a monastery where they kind of dedicate themselves to living the life of a Benedictine monk, but in lay society, you know, with families or whatever. But if you're not comfortable going to that step, just reading it and learning from it and learning how to govern your behavior and your habits is hugely influential. And beneficial for your spiritual life.
Yeah, the whole idea of order interacting with your daily liberty, right?
Right, exactly, so. Exactly. And you know, there's a lot that we can learn from that. And that's really, you know, again, to go back to the work I'm doing here with the Portsmouth Institute, we want to bring that message to kind of the idea makers at the top level. But we also are cognizant of the fact that, you know, our home base, if you will, is at a boarding school for high school students, and that's at Portsmouth Abbey, at St. Louis Abbey. It's a day school for all boys, high school aged.
Right.
And so, you know, I think one thing that we think about in the mission of the Portsmouth Institute, which, you know, is to explore Catholic thought in the Benedictine tradition, but one thing that you know is among our priorities is to help. In any way that we can, form the habits of the children here at the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, we're not the institute itself isn't replacing what the school does in that regard. But I think it's assisting it in certain crucial
ways. Of course,
ways,
it's the
especially,
same mission.
You know, by bringing in people who can speak about their experiences and speak about the intellectual life and how that relates to the spiritual life. And, you know, I think we have a real benefit here. You know, a lot of the institutes like the Portsmouth Institute are based at universities, and they do great intellectual work there, and they do great work with students. I think one benefit that we have is catching students while they are high school age and before they start developing the habits of life that make it really hard to embrace faith full-heartedly and to really live a life of orthodoxy. Because once you start down developing habits, you know, that are harmful to a life of virtue, it's really hard to pull yourself out.
Habits are hard to break. We want good habits, not bad habits. And we'll have to leave it there, Chris. I've been talking the show's about out of time, and I want to thank you, Chris Fisher from the Portsmouth Institute, for coming on Faith and Reason and sharing with us today about your institute and talking about Durkheim and society. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Dr. John Pinero. You've been listening to Faith and Reason.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is a professor of history and director of Catholic studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.